Livestock are an important aspect of agriculture, but where there are animals, there is a need for those who specialize in caring for them. Hello everyone and welcome to the Rural Perspectives Podcast. I'm Adam Albrecht with A Country Farm Credit Services, and today we're going to be talking about animal doctors, also known as veterinarians. Joining us to speak about this topic is our special guest, Gerald Stucka, who serves as an associate professor of animal sciences at North Dakota State University. Welcome, Gerald.
Thank you, Adam.
Now, take us into the world of being an animal doctor. What's it like treating creatures that don't exactly speak the same language you and I do?
It's a fascinating profession to be in, and one that I'm very, very proud to be a part of. I believe that veterinarians, at least those that deal, and I'm primarily livestock these days, but with almost all species, there's a certain sense of that the animal's trying to tell you something. Whether it's an individual animal or in the livestock business, whether it's a group or a herd or a certain size of animals, they're trying to tell you something by their behavior, by their movements, and sometimes even audibly. And I will admit it probably takes some time to learn that language, but I find it very challenging and fascinating, and it's very satisfying when you're dealing with something that's a problem, that you can figure out what the problem is and end up finding a solution for it. So it's a great profession. I love being a part of it.
I think a lot of people have a good grasp on what it's like to be in medicine and serve humans, but what does the world of veterinarian medicine all entail?
I mean, it is in some respects a mirror image of the human medical field. The only thing is, and I would say this, perhaps we have two advantages. The animals, whether they be companion animals or livestock, have an owner. And so that there's always human-to-human communication, no matter if you're dealing with a problem or if you're dealing with preventive strategies. So there's that piece of the puzzle. So the idea that a veterinarian never has contact with other humans, you just have contact with animals, that's absolutely not true. It begins with human-to-human contact. The other part, though, is the what the animals are trying to describe to you, if there is a problem, what's going on. And that means you have to understand what normal is like. What does a normal animal do? If I have a cow or a calf that's not feeling well, I need to be able to recognize what those symptoms really are telling me. And then automatically in our own mind, if we're trying to deal with a problem, we go, well, what are those symptoms look like, and what's system, or what are the rule outs? We use the term rule outs a lot. In other words, those symptoms might fit a pattern for this disease, or maybe 10 diseases. We have to kind of sort through them and figure out which one maybe fits the most likely diagnosis. And then, of course, in addition to that, we can take blood samples, we can do tests to determine if we're right or wrong, and then figure out a solution, maybe a treatment, or maybe a prevention to see that it doesn't happen again.
There are a whole bunch of different animals out there that, of course, veterinarians treat. Is specialization a pretty common practice within the industry? I'm guessing it really is determined on the location and the cluster of animals that are around.
Yeah, you're right. Specialization has become much like in human medicine. Certainly not to that extent yet, but there are specialty boards within veterinary medicine that encompass different disciplines. But if I'm in rural practice, let's say, in a small town or even a larger city in rural practice, I'm going to see this person's livestock, whether it be sheep or cattle or horses, or in some cases swine, although that's been very narrow now with more modern production systems. But I'm also going to see their dogs and their cats and whatever pets they might have at their place. And so it's a satisfying profession from that standpoint, but also challenging because it means that you have to keep up with a lot of different things. It's not like dealing with one species on the human side. It's dealing with many species. So while specialization is there, the need for a rural practitioner to be able to see many different types of animals is still a great need.
Now, based on your experience, what was or what is the best part about being a veterinarian?
Oh, my. You know, I really think that being looked upon within your community as a professional, as one who has accepted the challenges of more education, gone through all the obstacles or the challenges that it takes to get through a veterinary college education and be licensed and certified to practice, And so you're treated most often in a little bit different manner by your community. You're looked upon as someone that is living in your community that can contribute, and perhaps not even in a way just with animal health and animal care, but in other ways beyond just that. So, and I would encourage my veterinarians, sometimes they don't think of themselves this way, but they are looked upon as a highly valued community member. And that's important. It really is. I think that, you know, especially when veterinarians are in practice by themselves or they're maybe feeling like they're overworked and maybe sometimes abused, remember that most people look upon you very favorably. And then there's polling information that tells us that's true.
Now, you and your colleagues here at NDSU get to teach the next generation of veterinarians, but I'm guessing some research is also conducted. Yeah. How important are universities to animal medicine?
Yeah, it's huge. You know, the land-grant universities, like what NDSU is, began as a vehicle to improve understanding and science in agriculture. So both farming agriculture and livestock agriculture, and that began a long time ago. And so the research we do here, at least the research that I participate in, is pretty applied research. In other words, you don't have to dig too deep to figure out how this applies to my operation or to someone's operation within the Northern Plains or even nationwide and even globally in some cases. And so I look upon the things we do here as not just animal research, but we also have to remember that the end result is a food product and a highly nutritious, dense food product that is actually coveted around the world. And we're trying to make our food supplies not only safe, but of high quality and affordable at the same time. And so I look at what we do here as important, not only to just animal health and how we care for them and stewardship of land and livestock, but ultimately to all the products that come out of our livestock industry.
You would think about the way that diseases take hold and they change and they can rapidly evolve.
Yeah.
I would assume then that makes research at universities that much more important to the field as well.
Yeah, it does. You know, I think there are some research that is done that gets very focused on perhaps just the pathogens that are involved. Much of what we do here, what I am involved with, is not so much pathogen per se, but it's the animal husbandry, the care, the behavior of the animals, and how we can maximize the management opportunities that our producers deal with to reduce the risk of these animals becoming sick with a specific pathogen. And I guess I'll use this example, Adam. We call it calf scours or neonatal calf diarrhea. Pretty common disease that impacts calves anywhere from maybe 3, maybe 5 days of age till 2 weeks. Most of the time, this is a disease of management. If I have cows that are calving in difficult weather circumstances, if I have cows that are calving into a congested area, I increase the risk of those pathogens being passed on to those calves. And so if there's anything I can do from a management standpoint, whether it be nutrition to the cows, whether it be spreading those cows out, whether it be changing the calving season, whether it be looking at my genetic selection to make sure I have calves that are born easily and get up and nurse quickly, all of those things are much more important than necessarily what pathogen we're dealing with, but they're more important in reducing the risk of neonatal calf diarrhea. And so we focus a lot on that.
So it's really getting ahead of the game, being proactive on what you can control.
Absolutely. And I say all those management things, and that's not to discount the value of preventative vaccination. We've done several vaccine studies here at NDSU, and we understand how important vaccination strategies, protocols are so important in preventive medicine on the livestock side, as they are on the human side. And so we don't discount the value of vaccinations, but we also try and focus on the management strategies that can reduce the risk of animals becoming sick.
Herd immunity, you'll hear about quite a bit.
Yes, I'm a big proponent of understanding herd immunity. So if I look at, let's say, here's the example I use. West Nile virus. West Nile virus can impact human beings, can impact horses. If I vaccinate a group of horses for West Nile virus, I'm really not looking for herd immunity in that group. I'm looking for individual immunity. Each horse has to be immunized to protect itself against West Nile virus because the vector, the way that that virus is spread is by the mosquito, okay? Picks it up from birds into the mosquito and then to the horse. So unless I vaccinated mosquitoes, I'm probably not going to make much progress. So that's individual immunity. It's very important. It's just like rabies vaccinations in dogs and cats and in livestock. Herd immunity is different in that we are trying to immunize, and I use the term immunize instead of vaccination, immunize a herd so that a high percentage of the animals are indeed immune. And what happens is that you stop or really slow down the rate of transmission within that herd of specific viruses and or bacteria. And that's how herd immunity works. And it works in the human population as well. The great example is measles, highly contagious virus that can work through a population that's susceptible. The higher the number, the higher the percent that is immunized against measles, it can't gain a foothold and transmit.
We're going to talk a little bit more about some of these modern day diseases that have popped up in recent years or even currently in a little bit. But I just want to ask, for those listening along who think that this is kind of a really interesting topic, or they might be interested in getting into a career of veterinarian medicine, what type of opportunities exist for them?
Yeah, I still think the opportunities are great. I mean, we have professions always go having a turnover rate. There's a lot of veterinarians, even in our state, that are getting like I am. They're a little bit at a certain age and may want to slow down or may want to look to retirement. One of the needs is finding those young people that are wanting to come into the veterinary profession that are willing to live in rural areas. And this is a symptom, really, of many of the professions, how difficult it is to get medical doctors to come to rural areas, dentists and other professionals. The same thing holds true for veterinarians. And so the opportunity is there. And I guess I would encourage, especially those young people that are from rural areas, if they want to aspire to veterinary education, to work hard, study hard, do your best and see if you can be admitted, and then make a commitment to come back to your state or your area. And you may not come back right away. You may go spend some years elsewhere and hone your skills a little bit more and then come back. But living in a rural community is a little bit different than living in a huge metropolitan area, and you have to be willing to understand that. And sometimes dual career couples find it difficult because the opportunities aren't there. But again, as we talked earlier, Adam, being a part of a community that's maybe a little bit smaller in size, you will be a highly valued member of that community, and you contribute in ways that are way beyond just your veterinary medicine skills.
Now, you see some headlines in some newspapers or on the radio or wherever that talk about a shortage of veterinarians out there, large animal vets out in rural communities that are vital. How big of a problem is this?
There may not actually be a veterinary shortage as per se. It is in many cases related to the issue we just talked about, the opportunities for dual career positions if they happen to be married or with another person, and also economic. There is a business of veterinary medicine, and it has to be economically viable. Not every little community will be able to have a veterinarian. And so I guess our producers and our stakeholders need to understand that as well. If you have a veterinarian in your community, you need to support that veterinarian and do what you can to make sure that it is economically viable. And from a business standpoint, it has to be run like a business. And I say that with some caveats because not every patient that comes in the door, not every person that's with that patient or group of animals that comes in the door will necessarily be an economic decision that you have to make. I got a specific example of a cat that I had a broken femur. It was actually a head of the femur had fractured and obviously a displaced hip. Okay, so I spent a little time and put that cat under anesthesia and took out the head of the femur. And when it's a light cat like that, they'll heal up just fine. And I still remember charging $35 for that procedure. So, and sometimes that's the beauty of veterinary medicine. There are some clients that, depending on circumstances, you might treat just a little bit differently. But always in the back of your mind, you have to remember that I still have to run a business. And so I encourage our young people, when they come into practice, when they come into running their own business, it's always good to spend time with people that have run a business before. But hone your business skills, make sure it's economically viable, and you'll have a very satisfying career if you do that.
The demographic trends out there clearly show that urban areas are getting bigger, but some rural areas are losing population, which has some real ramifications, of course, for veterinary medicine. What would be the impact of both farmers and consumers if a shortage of people in the living out in the rural areas want to practice this type of medicine?
Yeah, what happens is that, you know, for many herd visits, those things can be scheduled and taken care of, even if you're X number of miles away. In our practice area, we would drive as far as 90 miles one way just to do some herd visits. When it comes down to individual animal medicine, let's say I have a heifer and she's calved and unable to deliver that calf and requires a cesarean section, or a C-section as we call it, that becomes much more problematic. It is a time-sensitive emergency. And so the farther you get away from a primary care like that, the more difficult it becomes. And that's where you end up with sometimes laymen trying to handle those situations by themselves, and it's sometimes the outcome is not what you wanted. And that's the downside of that sort of thing. Now, I could envision maybe an urban setting for a veterinary clinic, and maybe there are satellite clinics that go out in some of these rural areas. And it still doesn't address the issue of emergencies, but, you know, maybe that's part of the solution. So the going back to your original question about shortage of veterinarians, it's not so much a shortage, it's economic viability and lack of opportunity sometimes in these small rural communities.
We're speaking with Gerald Stucca, who serves as an associate professor of animal sciences at North Dakota State University. We're seeing some food companies market animal protein products as antibiotic-free. From a veterinarian's perspective, do you feel that this impacts the work that you do?
Yes, it does. We have a tremendous number of antibiotics at our disposal that we can use to treat animals that actually need them. And remember that antibiotics are used to treat bacterial infections for which that bacteria is known to be susceptible to that antibiotic. And so we're grateful for the privilege of being able to use those antibiotics. The discussion over the last perhaps 10 years or more has been making sure that we use them only when they're necessary and using them at the right dose and for the right diagnosis and so on and so forth. And so I think we've pretty much taken that to heart as a veterinary profession. Many of our veterinary professional associations, AVMA, AABP, Academy of Veterinary Consultants, for example, have position statements on the use of antibiotics. So we take it very seriously, especially in the livestock side, because we, again, know that we're producing a product that ends up in people's food choices. And so it's important to remember that antibiotics are necessary, that we'll use them when necessary. But it's also important to remember that every time we treat an animal with an antibiotic, there is a certain withdrawal time that is put on that label, and it's adhered to very, very carefully, because we never want any residues to enter into the food supply. And I would say this as well. Most of the time, if we treat an animal, that animal is relatively at a young age. And so by the time that animal ever goes to market, he may be as far as 6 to 8 months away from when he actually received that antibiotic. So the withdrawal time is hundreds of days from when that animal was actually treated. So I think sometimes people get the idea that if an animal was treated 6 months ago, there must still be a little bit antibiotic left in his system. I would say that would be very unlikely. I mean, if you were to go down to the parts per trillion or quadrillion or something, perhaps, but there basically is no antibiotic left in the system. So we adhere to these withdrawal times. We make sure that animals are marketed in a timely fashion. And then always remember this, we have a food safety inspection service, that if there's any reason at all to test an animal to see if there's any residue left, they will find it if it's there. And then there's some rather severe consequences for marketing animals that haven't met that withdrawal time.
Do you feel that this practice leads to a lot of misinformation that's out there within consumers who don't know any better?
It does. The discussion these days has been that the use of antibiotics is contributing to antibiotic resistance in human beings. And I guess as I've looked at what literature is out there, scientific literature, it looks like the risk of resistant strains getting into the human population from the use in animals is extremely low. So we know that antibiotics are used in the human side, and sometimes our human counterparts have not been perhaps even as careful as veterinarians in who they prescribe it to. Come in with a sore throat, I got an earache, and all of a sudden you get automatically get an antibiotic. I'm not saying that's true all the time, but that sometimes does happen, and we need to be wise no matter what profession you're in when it comes to the use of antibiotics.
We talked about some disease before, but there have been some high-profile cases of disease within livestock populations in the last couple of years or in the last 5 years, for example. Avian influenza in poultry a few years ago, and African swine fever is really breaking loose in other countries. They can really wreak havoc in a population, can't they?
Yeah, they can. African swine fever, for example, is considered a foreign animal disease. We don't have it in this country. We're very careful to keep it out of this country, and that's why there's inspection service and making sure we know where animals are coming from, in this case, swine, because it's a devastating disease causing high fatality rates. So that in the case of African swine fever, there's a case where vaccination is not practiced. Eradication is the way to keep that disease at bay and out of your country. And so in a country like China, for example, that is a high user of pork products and have a huge population of swine, the results of that disease are devastating because literally millions of swine will be lost. And the challenge for us in the United States is to make sure that we are not increasing the risk of that virus coming over here. You know, there's some information that tells us sometimes importing products from countries with diseases like that, whether it be feedstuffs even, may increase the risk of bringing that virus over. It doesn't have to be necessarily in an animal. And so we have to be really careful about those sorts of things. And the other thing is, I guess it increases the desire when you have that many animals that are lost and you still have protein needs to be met, animal protein needs, then it puts pressure on the market to meet those needs, and it forces some of those products to be higher priced, making them, in some cases, less available, especially in underdeveloped countries. So it's a very serious case. And now the avian influenza deal, that's a little different too, because there's really no immunization in animals for avian influenza. And as you might understand, when we have migratory birds, that makes this issue of keeping it out very, very difficult. And so many of our poultry, turkeys, and chickens, for example, are one of the reasons they're raised indoors is part of this biosecurity reasons, even though we did have outbreak a number of years ago. But that's one of the reasons for the way we raise some of those animals today is because of biosecurity issues and actually directly related to avian influenza, amongst others.
Now, we've talked about herd immunity. We've talked about some animal husbandry practices. Is there anything else that farmers and ranchers can really do to keep this stuff out of their herds or out of their flocks?
I'll speak to the beef cattle industry sometimes. I think we get a little bit lax. The swine industry's figured this out. The poultry industry figured this out. Where you don't just waltz in to a poultry or a turkey or a swine operation. You will have to, in some cases, take a shower, take your clothes off, and put new clothes on. We've been a little more lax on the beef cattle side, there's no question, even on the dairy side. And I think it behooves us as veterinarians and as producers to be a little bit more careful about not only just who comes into our operations, but what. I'm a little bit more careful about bringing new animals into my place, whether it's a cow or a bull I've purchased. Is it coming from a herd that I am pretty confident isn't carrying some disease into my herd, like Yoni's disease, for example, or bovine leukosis or anaplasmosis? I think it behooves us all to be just a little bit more thoughtful about bringing animals in. Maybe there's some testing requirements that has to be done before I'm going to willing to go through a barrier that I think I've constructed and bring in a new animal on that may be infectious enough to put my operation into a bad place regarding a new pathogen that I don't currently have.
Now, in your experience as a practicing vet and also in this research setting, have you ever found yourself dealing with any of these deadly diseases?
Not the African swine fever, and the avian influenza was pretty much out of my area of expertise, although we certainly talked about it when it was going on, or porcine diarrhea virus that went through the swine a number of years ago. But as it relates to cattle, you know, I've been pretty fortunate not to have to deal with, for example, brucellosis or TB necessarily, because they're highly regulated diseases and the state veterinary, State Board of Animal Health gets involved with those. It's more some of the diseases that can end up being a little bit chronic in your herd. Yoni's disease is an example of a disease that may get into a herd and cause very low death loss, but you know it's there and you never want to sell animals to somebody else if you've got that disease in your herd. Bovine leucosis is a little bit of a mysterious kind of disease, but again, it doesn't usually end up in huge death loss. It's just kind of a chronic illness in that herd. Anaplasmosis is a little different, and most of the time that impacts herds that are farther south from us, blood-sucking insects and that sort of thing. So it's not huge death loss. It's not always the headline-making diseases that we see, but certainly biosecurity is involved in making sure we don't have to deal with some of those.
We know it can be very tough to be a farmer or rancher and to see the loss of their animals. But how about on the other side of the table, being a vet, what is that like?
You know, I think for most veterinarians, and myself included, it becomes a situation where you feel it yourself. You really do. If a producer is dealing with losses, whether it's in calves or in cows, it's hard to go to sleep at night thinking about, have I missed something? Could I have impacted a change in that operation? And I get calls from veterinarians very often. They're dealing with a problem, and I know they're feeling it, and they want to help this client in any way they can, and they're calling me to see, did I miss something? Did I miss a sign here that it should have pointed me in a certain direction? From a veterinarian standpoint, you know, it's a mental situation, a mental condition, and ideally if you're dealing with too many, but it does become personal because a lot of times our clients are not only our clients, but they're our friends as well.
Are there any final thoughts you'd like to leave listeners with about the field of veterinarian medicine?
You know, I think my position here, Adam, has given me an opportunity to talk about things that are beyond just what we would consider classic veterinary medicine. My position as extension veterinarian, but also as livestock stewardship person, has made me realize, and I hope I'm communicating these messages to others as well, the importance of veterinarians being kind of a systems approach person. That they think of stewardship on the land that the cattle run, the land that the forages are raised. They also are stewards of the animals in the care and husbandry and feeding of animals. They're also a steward of the people they come in contact with. So whether it be clients coming in the door, whether it be 4-H kids, or whether it be completely city dwellers, urban dwellers that don't have any understanding at all about agriculture, it's a tremendous opportunity for me, but I also want it to be a tremendous opportunity for our rural practitioners to bring the message of agriculture, what we do, why we do these things, how important livestock agriculture is to our country, to the food supply of our country, and globally. It's a huge challenge, but I find it a very exciting opportunity to visit with as many people as I get an opportunity to visit with.
Well, Gerald, thank you very much for coming on and speaking with us. This has been a really fascinating topic.
Thank you, Adam.
That's Gerald Stucka, who serves as an associate professor of animal sciences at North Dakota State University. That will do it for us on this episode of the Rural Perspectives Podcast, which is a production of A Country Farm Credit Services. To get more great content, please visit www.acountry.ca.